Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As readers, glimpsing the private life of an author can at times give us new insights into their writings. This becomes a tricky line for writers. How much do they reveal of themselves, if at all, in telling a story? How much do they unwittingly reveal of themselves through their characters and actions in their novels? My guest today will be speaking about this in a lecture at the University of Tulsa tomorrow evening when he speaks on Public Selves, Private Selves, from James Joyce to David Foster Wallace. D.T. Max is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where he wrote about the grandson of James Joyce, Stephen James Joyce, the executor of the Joyce estate, who over the past few decades has almost single-handedly thwarted scholars from quoting or accessing Joyce's copyrighted material. He's also the author of the acclaimed biography, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, A Life of David Foster Wallace, the story of the late 20th century writer best known for The Infinite Jest, who committed suicide in 2008. He'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Terrell Hall on the TU campus in a free lecture, and he joins us today by phone on Studio Tulsa. D.T. Max, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're speaking about division in writers between their private and public lives, and readers want to know more about the writer's reason for understanding it in the way they tell a story. So we want to know more about those private lives. You've chosen to focus on two which have a very rich division between private and public lives. That's James Joyce and David Foster Wallace. What was your interest in that division?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of an artifact of the fact. So I'm a writer at The New Yorker, and one of the pieces I did a few years back was on Stephen James Joyce, who is the grandson of James Joyce, and a kind of famously aggressive protector of his grandfather's privacy. So that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, I wrote a biography called Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. It came out a couple of years ago, which is about David Foster Wallace. And so you might say that talk is a little bit of an artifact of just two writers about whom I know a fair amount and about whose kind of relationship to privacy and publicity I know a fair amount.
Well, in both of the case of these writers, we do want to know more about their personal lives to help better understand their writing. Certainly that's the case with Joyce, because so many of the situations Joyce wrote about, we wonder how much of this was autobiographical, biographical. And in the case of Stephen James Joyce, the ruler of a foundation that basically doesn't want any inquiry into the private life of James Joyce.
Yeah, I think that, well, you have two writers in Joyce and David Foster Wallace whose work, you know, is essentially imaginative. I mean, these are two writers who did a great deal, whatever may be the basis in, you know, in their lives. One can really not speak of either book as having primarily a biographical or autobiographical interest. I mean, okay, sure, so that is James Joyce's Dublin, obviously enough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Wallace uses his own imagination to create the marvelous world of his incredible 1996 novel, Infinite Jest, that I don't think anybody really goes to either of those writers because they're looking for information about their own biography. It's not, you know, there's some writers for whom you could say that they take from their lives so extensively and so clearly that the biography really is almost a kind of a key to the novels. I don't think either of these writers really would qualify that way. But I do think that knowing about their lives enriches, if a biography is done well, it's going to enrich a reading of the writer's work. It's never going to substitute for it. It's not supposed to substitute for it. Every Love Story is a Ghost Story is truly designed for the reader who's either read some of David Foster Wallace or heard his name and doesn't quite know where to start. I mean, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story will both tell you where to start in a straightforward way, but also by orienting you into the life, tells you where to start. I think with Joyce, actually, the kind of thing that we're interested in is that the work is so majestic, so immense, that I think we want a little bit of knowledge about Joyce in order to, you know, in order to just begin to figure out, well, how and where? How are we going to get our piece of Ulysses, if you like, as readers? And I think that's where, you know, Stephen James Joyce, who's the grandson, just never wanted that. He never wanted it. You know, essentially never wanted anything to come out about his grandfather. Everything was too private.
Well, as you wrote in that profile, James Joyce himself was pretty reluctant to reveal himself. He was, in a lot of cases, he was litigious in his own way. And Stephen James Joyce has taken that to a new level. I mean, where he's almost for a long time, he stifled scholarly research into Joyce's writings because they were under copyright, as well as his private correspondence.
Yeah, he's, he's actually, Stephen James Joyce's behavior is a bit odder than just stifling. He's capricious. So he might let a pop song quote from Molly Bloom's Soliloquy, but, you know, a serious work of scholarship on Ulysses he would block. So it's almost just a kind of assertion of will, I think. You know, Oscar Wilde once memorably said that biography lends a new terror to death. And I don't think there's very, very few writers, perhaps none, who really thinks, oh, I can't wait for my biography. There's obviously an element at the same time of praise, right?
Right.
There's something generous in writing a biography of a person. It's an attempt to memorialize them. But I think by the time most writers get a biography, they sort of feel like they don't want a biography. Neither David Foster Wallace nor James Joyce, was hoping to be written about. Both of them wanted to disappear in the work. I think that's a very normal desire for a writer to want to disappear within the work. After a writer's death, though, I think that a kind of transition takes place where they go from being an essentially private individual who wrote to an artist about whom we'd like to know something. Not necessarily everything. I mean, really, there are limits to, I think, what we need to know. But we do want to know something. And I just think, as I said before, it enriches the work. Most writers see it as replacing their work. I understand that. But if you actually look at how biography is used, I think it's much more often used as a kind of a stepping stone to begin to read a writer. And certain writers, look, David Foster Wallace and James Joyce have in common a certain amount of difficulty, textual difficulty. I wouldn't say that they're, I don't think Ulysses is that hard. Finnegan's Wake is a difficult book to read. Ulysses can be difficult, but it's an extraordinarily rewarding book to read. Infinite Jest, David Foster Wallace's great novel, similarly can be difficult, but an incredibly rewarding book to read. So I think biography can be quite useful in both their cases. The stuff, there's stuff Stephen James Joyce, he loves to say, I'm not a Joycean, I'm a Joyce. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very illuminating. So he means he's not a disciple, a follower, a scholar of Joyce. He is, blood of Joyce. But I actually think that's exactly the wrong point to make, because I think actually once a writer's gone, it's more interesting, it's more meaningful what the Joyceans want, what the Wallaceans want, to make up a phrase, than it is what Stephen James Joyce wants. He's a grandson. I understand the feeling of protectiveness, but I don't really, I can't trace it to anything bigger than just, at this point I just think that James Joyce identifiably belongs to the world. And I think David Foster Wallace is making that transition as well. And it is difficult and can be difficult for people who knew a writer personally to find that this flesh and blood individual has suddenly been converted into an artifact. Like when I wrote Every Love Should Be a Ghost Story, my goal was, I knew there would be some people who knew him so well, family and so on, for whom it would be really, really hard. It would be really, really hard to please them. And I understood that.
Mm-hmm.
But I did want to write a book that was good enough that his close friends would read it and know that it was him, know that I had captured him properly. It was very rewarding to me after Every Love Story came out that David Foster Wallace's friends did tell me that I had gotten him right. But, there's a lot of kind of nonsense has grown up around David Foster Wallace.
Right.
And I think that everybody wanted to see a little bit more who he really was.
Now, did you run into that difficulty from certain people who were related or within the family or outside of the family who felt like, certainly not.
I mean, there's nothing remotely comparable to Stephen James Joyce. I don't think there is in most estates. No, actually, I mean, the biography was not authorized. You don't really want your biography to be authorized, but it received generous assistance from family and intimate friends. I think everybody was interested in a book that told the truth, that was, that was revealing but honest and human. I was lucky because, there are estates and there are families that have no interest in that. Not just Stephen James Joyce. I mean, it's not that uncommon to have an estate that only wants, some sort of sugar-coated biography. But what's the point of that? I mean, that's a lie to the author's work. In the end, I think what I most admired about everybody around David was that they didn't want a book that was less honest than his books were.
Mm-hmm. And if you can talk about writing that biography because of his situation, seriously depressed really since the end of high school almost.
Right.
Was it difficult to discern his story, or was it pretty well laid out?
Well, I think one of the tricky things, so David Foster Wallace, you know, he only died in 2008.
Yeah, right.
And so I began a biography almost immediately afterward. That's certainly awkward. I mean, there's no other way to think about it. I was amazed to find that I wasn't. My biography began as a piece in The New Yorker.
And right.
I'm a staff writer, and so I was amazed to find that I wasn't the first person writing about David Foster Wallace. But there was actually already another feature magazine writer, a very capable writer named David Lipsky, who wound up publishing a book called Although in the End You End Up Becoming Yourself, It's Slightly Wrong. But that's the idea. The main point is about to come out as a movie called The Last Tour. But anyway, I was second, so that was a little bit of a kind of sop to my moral sense. But what I, you know, the thing about David that made it easier about David Foster Wallace was that his father had talked about his son's depression in the obituary in the New York Times. And so, because David never talked about it during his life. So what in the case of another writer might have been the most, you know, kind of confidential thing was, I think, one wonderfully for people who care about both David and people who themselves have mental health issues, it was public, you know, and that was really helpful because that this thing that might have been the unspoken thing, certainly in another era, you know, severe depression might have been something that people would be very anxious about discussing,
right,
was something we could all discuss freely. So that was the positive. The hardest thing about writing about David's life, because, you know, he was a contemporary of mine and didn't really, I think, expect a biography, it's just, you know, every love story is a ghost story. I mean, first of all, it's the story of life. So the first thing, if you want to tell the story of your life, is you want to say where you were in a given year. You know, like, where was David in 1986? There wasn't really documentation. I had to find it all. Mm-hmm. Writing about, you know, Stephen James Joyce, though, or James Joyce would be different because you'd already have the magnificent Richard Ellman biography of Joyce, the papers of which actually reside in Tulsa.
Right.
All Ellman's papers do, and they're terrific. But anyway, so, you know, he did the work I did with Wallace, Ellman did for Joyce. And actually, there are a couple who went before him in a way. But the basic job of telling us where Joyce was, you know, on a given day in a given year was really work that Ellman did. So the writers who are trying to write about Joyce now, including the biographers, are really, they're really glossers. I mean, they're really writers trying to give a new interpretation to a life, the facts around which are pretty settled. So in a sense, they're two opposite examples.
Right. But in the case of David Foster Wallace, though, in one way it was good because he really did embrace the Internet, from what I can see. He kept copious notebooks and almost, you know, in one of your articles, you reproduce a page from the notebook, and it's just this jumble of material, everything from, you know, addresses being crossed out.
Right.
He was a person who worked on paper, really.
Yeah, but didn't, you know, the thing is, Rich, he didn't keep the paper. So there's actually not that much, at least not that much that surfaced up till now. So there's only a handful of notebooks, maybe four or five.
Wow.
Even though he was always keeping a notebook, so I don't know where the other notebooks went. He may have destroyed them. He wasn't the keeper of things. So, for instance, you know, his letters, I have had access to a lot of the letters that David Foster Wallace wrote to people, but the letters he got back, I saw almost none. Unless the sender kept a copy, David didn't seem to have kept a copy, or generally didn't keep a copy. So it's harder in that way than you think. And then remember also, when you live in this era we live in, because your life is so sort of abundantly annotated online, you don't really make a huge effort to organize it in your own private papers. And online stuff doesn't tend to last. I mean, there are a lot of people who I approached who had some emails from David but couldn't get them off their computers, you know?
Wow.
I mean, how many computers do you have sitting around with hard drives that you meant at some point to get
that's
to.
Right. It goes back about 4 or 5 years, and that's about it. And when you upgrade your computer, now, there goes your life.
Yeah, exactly. So, and with James Joyce, you actually have the, I mean, the real problem with Joyce, or when I wrote the article, the main focus really isn't on writing about Joyce. I don't know that there's a biography, another biography in the offing. There just was one. But, you know, he was really incensed most of all about a biography they'd written about one of Joyce's daughter. He was, you know, he was upset about critics who were using too many quotations from Joyce in their scholarship. He doesn't really esteem Joyce scholars. He thinks they're kind of, you know, ants crawling around the picnic of Joyce's beautiful prose. And so, I mean, he fundamentally doesn't respect them.
Right.
And so he makes their lives difficult. And to some extent, I understand how a person who actually knew Joyce might feel that way. But it strikes me as essentially, and I wrote this, essentially a wrong stance. I mean, it's really a failure to let an artist migrate from the private sphere to the public sphere, which is, you know, ultimately where Joyce belongs. He doesn't really belong to Stephen James Joyce anymore, except in the smallest way he belongs to all of us. And I don't know why Stephen James Joyce can't rejoice about that. I don't understand why that's a thought that's so difficult for him to embrace. I think in the case of David Foster Wallace, so you have a much more immediate, obviously, vastly more immediate and hurt place. You know, the sense of grief surrounding David and part of his friends and family was enormous, obviously. But even within that grief, they were able to, I think, see the fact that his story honestly and truly told would serve a purpose. You know, just it would serve a purpose for the readers who loved his writing, but it would also serve a purpose for people who were depressed the way he was.
Mm-hmm.
And then fundamentally, I just think they trusted me to do it. You know, I think Stephen James Joyce doesn't trust any of these people to do it, or maybe only trusts himself. You know, he's essentially a biographer, never wrote the biography.
My guest today is D.T. Max, a staff writer for The New Yorker, author of Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, A Life of David Foster Wallace. He'll be speaking about Wallace as well as James Joyce in a lecture at the University of Tulsa Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock on public selves, private selves. Getting back to, again, this idea of understanding the writer's intention better through knowing more about the writer. You mentioned that David Foster Wallace never spoke about his depression, but he did have characters that showed some of those hallmarks.
Yeah, he was a terrific writer about depression. There's a character named Kate Gompert in his work Infinite Jest who's in a psych ward and casts this absolutely no eye on exactly what's going to happen, you know, what it's like in a psych ward. You know, and clearly, you don't have to be a genius to figure out that kind of knowledge didn't come from reading books on David's part. There's also a wonderful story called The Depressed Person, in which a young woman kind of goes very capably, I think, through the stages of depression and the way your friends respond to you when you're deeply depressed. But he never, you know, he wasn't a memoir writer. He wrote almost no memoir. And that memoir that he did write is kind of arch and deliberately reflects away from himself. He wrote a wonderful piece on American usage in Harper's, and in that article he talks about his family as being sort of militant grammarians. And that's as far really as you can get in knowing much about David from his own writing. So I don't think he wanted to be a memoir writer. I think he felt fiction was a much higher calling and that what you could do when you created fiction was more special than what you could do when you write memoir. Also, you know, in keeping, I think, with many depressed people, David Foster Wallace was highly secretive. I mean, one of the reasons that I think that I got so much cooperation for the biography is that David Foster Wallace's own friends wanted to know who he had been. Very few of them had the whole picture, even a big piece of the picture. He was somebody who kind of tended to put his friends into separate, you know,
compartmentalized
plots. Yeah, keep them kind of apart, and he tended to sort of blow into people's lives and then blow back out. So there are a lot of people who knew him intensely at certain periods in his life, but knew nothing about him later. And so all of those people, and many of them he had written to, you know, were willing and even eager to sort of pay in the hopes of getting something out of it.
You had a New Yorker article, and this is actually, I think it was a little bit after publication, where you told the story of your title, which you fell in love with that title when you ran across it the first time, and it's Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. It gives us a sense of how you're trying to discern facts and figure out where it came from, because I think Wallace actually said he heard Virginia Woolf on The Tonight Show mention this line. And you kind of, this article gives us the whole sort of detective story and figuring out where this line came from.
Yeah, it's, you know, the Every Love Story is a Ghost Story was one of those titles that every writer hopes his publisher will like but worries that they won't. But to my delight, Viking, my publisher, when they heard the suggestion, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, thought, what a terrific title for a biography. When people ask me what it means, you know, it means a bunch of things, but I think we all intuitively feel like David Foster Wallace's relationship to literature and writing was a kind of love story that, because it ends with his suicide, is a ghost story. And that's really the primary meaning that I want you to get from it. There are others, you know, in a sense you could say every biographer. I think a biographer should always be in love with his subject, whether he writes adoringly about him or not. And the subject is also, generally speaking, going to be dead. And so every love story is a ghost story for a biographer.
Right. That's a true story.
Well, it's a phrase David used that you're exactly right. So there's a couple of letters he wrote where the phrase just pops up at the bottom of the letter, and he attributes it one time to Virginia Woolf on the Johnny Carson show, and then I think another time he attributes it to Virginia Woolf on the Merv Griffin show, if I remember right, which is a really dated reference. But it also pops up in his fiction. It's just thrown in there as a sentence now and then. Every love story is a ghost story. It pops up, you know, in a couple of stories, different places, and it's even in The Pale King, his posthumous book. So it's a phrase, I think, that entertained him for a while, and that he never made a huge amount out of. And I like the fact it wasn't a key, it wasn't a phrase he found key in his work, but it was a phrase I found key in his work. So I began to try and figure out where it came from, and it gets incredibly convoluted and weird, because the answer for where it comes from is that Tim O'Brien wrote a story called The Things They Carried, a wonderful story. And if you go and you read the book version of The Things They Carried, it does not have that phrase in there. It's only in the story as it was originally published. So David starts using the phrase before the story is published, if I remember right. And the reason that he could do that is I believe he went to hear Tim O'Brien talk when he was a graduate student at the University of Arizona. So that's, on the one hand, the answer. But what's weirder is that Tim O'Brien is not the only writer to use the phrase. Christina Stead is a wonderful writer who wrote The Man Who Loved Children, the very ironically titled Man Who Loved Children book. An Australian writer, in her notebooks, also uses the phrase, and even had an unpublished short story with that title. There's no way she and Tim O'Brien would have known each other or exchanged the phrase. So it's just one of these Borgesian moments where two writers come up with the same phrase independently. And then a third writer just likes it and starts popping it into his short stories and his fiction, and then his biographer likes it and makes it the title of his book. So there's just this long, complicated, you know, not entirely clear route from, you could say, Tim O'Brien's first use of the phrase or Christina Stead to my making it the title of Every Love Story is a Ghost Story.
Yeah. My guest today is D.T. Max. He will be a guest at the University of Tulsa this Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock, speaking about his biography of David Foster Wallace, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story. Also talking a little bit about James Joyce, who he's followed in as a journalist. And it was mentioned that Stephen James Joyce interview earlier. You know, a lot of the power of the Joyce estates is on the verge of expiration, because I know a lot of things went into the public domain about 2 to 3 years ago. I think some of the unpublished things are still under a copyright, but it sounds like all he's doing is delaying the inevitable, that eventually Joyce will be a public figure.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, but, you know, delaying the inevitable is not without its pleasures. If you can keep things out of scholars' hands for another 10 years, you know, that's probably not a bad day's work from Stephen James Joyce's point of view. I'm not 100% up on what's gone into the public domain. It's incredibly complicated in the case of Joyce, because I think of the initial publication of Ulysses, if I remember right, did not enjoy copyright protection, or arguably it doesn't. I remember the details. You know, copyright has changed over the years. It's become much easier to get copyright to your work. All you have to do is create your work, and technically it's copyrighted. You used to have to, if I remember right, you used to have to actually file a copy of the work with the Library of Congress, and publishers still do, to be on the safe side, but you don't have to. Copyright is innate in writing. You know, if you write a laundry list, you have protected rights to the use of that laundry list. But when you get to books that have these publication histories and that were first published, you know, before World War II, I think it gets extremely extremely complicated. Someone in that Stephen James Joyce article says fair use is the right to hire a lawyer. And I think that's a very telling phrase, because if you're going to try to claim fair use, which is the right to use a certain amount of material from a copywritten work, and you come up against an aggressive defender of the estate like Stephen James Joyce, you're certainly possible you're going to wind up in court, whatever the right of, whoever has the right in the situation.
Right. Well, I want to ask in the last minute or so what you're up to these days. When we look at the New Yorker, I've seen a series of profiles on what seem to be a number of brilliant people in widely desperate fields. Most recently, Hans Ulrich Oberst of the Serpentine Gallery, sort of the super curator, if you will. Magnus Carlsen, the chess grandmaster. Jack Dorsey, co-founder of Twitter, and Mark Terchik from the Nature Conservancy. Is there an overarching theme to these profiles?
Well, I think with the exception of Mark, I would throw in Hélène Grimaud, who's a wonderful French pianist. For a while, I seem to have been put on the kind of Mensa beat, But I'm working on two pieces now that have nothing, it's really accidental. What I've always tried to do in my work is to avoid repetition, for better or worse. And so, for instance, my first book, the book before the David Foster Wallace biography, is a book about insomnia. And a family in Italy have had an inherited insomnia for 200 years. And my main goal when I write is not to cover the same territory twice. And for that matter, I'm working on a rather strange book about Mark Twain. But, I think we had a series of pieces there that just happened to be about, insanely bright people.
Eccentrically bright people, yeah.
Yeah, kind of broken the mold. I mean, the way David Foster Wallace could also be fit into that category of that basically, the pieces about the kid who sit next to you in high school who you always knew was going to be famous, but you couldn't figure out what they'd be famous for. I think everybody in that group wins that award. But the stuff I'm doing now is somewhat different. My hope is always to be surprised in my writing and to learn. And when I learn in my writing, I feel that the reader learns too. I've always felt that if you know too much about a subject, you have a tendency to leave out the things that are actually most interesting to a reader. It's one of the kind of hazards of having a beat. And so I try very hard not to become, so expert in a subject that I'll bore you.
Well, we look forward to the next project, whatever it is, and look forward to your appearance in Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
D.T. Max is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, A Life of David Foster Wallace, which is now out in softcover. He'll be speaking about Wallace as well as James Joyce in a lecture at the University of Tulsa tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock in Turrell Hall on the TU campus, which is free and open to the public. He'll be speaking about public selves, private selves, from James Joyce to David Foster Wallace. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.